Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. Before we begin, may I remind you the obvious thing, please silence all electronic devices, anything that might make a little whirring or a little beeping or anything disruptive. We are very pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, please pick up a copy of the September-October newsletter at the front desk. I also want to let you know that this is a three-part series. Tonight is the first evening of a three-part series. If you registered for any one, you automatically have a space for either or both of the other sessions if you would like. Please see me to change or upgrade your registration. So if you like what you hear tonight and want to come back the next 2 weeks, you're welcome to, as you will. This event was made possible in part by a grant from the estate of Marion Naumburg, designated to expand our offerings in performance and other formats, and we are extremely grateful for that. We are also grateful to our dedicated member, the highly talented Bill Connington, for conceiving and organizing these evenings. Information on Mr. Connington and all our performers is in your playbill. For an introduction to the works you'll see presented, we'll now turn to him. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy the plays of Joyce Carol Oates.
Hi. Thank you all for coming. I just wanted to start by introducing the actors. We're lucky to have this talented group of people. This evening we have Jennifer McCabe, Emily Tremaine, Jeff Pagliano, Tony Wolfe, and Colin Sutherland with us. Michael Lawrence was meant to be with us, but he got a television job, and he's shooting right now. He's doing Damages with Glenn Close, so that's a nice job to have. He might be with us next week, depending on, he's recurring, so we'll see. But Tony is graciously filling in tonight. It's stating the obvious to say that you can't do drama without actors. Gertrude Stein tried. She got tired of working with actors and wrote plays for puppets, so she wouldn't have to work with actors. But I guess the joke was on her because puppeteers are actors too. Just ask the people who were in Avenue Q. Some people claim, for instance, that Shakespeare is preferable on the page, that it is superior to Shakespeare on the stage. This is not true if you have good actors. In the plays of Shakespeare or Joyce Carol Oates, it's possible to miss some important points if you're reading a script silently by yourself. If you are reading something that is difficult or complex or ambiguous or deeply disturbing, you may sometimes protect yourself unconsciously. Your eye may just skip over the hard part, like watching a horror movie and covering your eyes. But in a horror movie, if you're in a movie theater, in those moments you can hear everybody else scream. If you're reading and covering your eyes, you're missing the point. So actors acting a difficult play can make us more honest. In Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, we hear Willie's wife say, "Attention must be paid." In Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, after the question, "Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf?" we hear Martha answer, "I am, George. I am." In Joyce Carol Oates' Poor Bebe, which we're reading next week, the wife breaks the fourth wall at the end of the play to confront the audience when she says, referring to our innermost desperation and secrets and rage, she says, "And you, you damned hypocrites, what will you do with yours?" An actor asking us from the stage what we are going to do with our desperation and secrets and rage, this is tough stuff. No wonder our eyes might blip over it on the page. But when there is a living, breathing actor right in front of us with a voice and a body and a brain and emotions to bring life to the words that are just printed on pieces of paper, well, that's a pretty terrific thing. Joyce Carol Oates, as you know, is a very successful novelist. The phrase well-known literary novelist is almost an oxymoron, but that's what she is. Why would Ms. Oates bother to write a play when she could write a novel? When there is a reading public eager to lap up whatever she might put forth in book form? Ms. Oates is a very intelligent person. She is a member of the Academy of Arts and Letters, a winner of the National Book Award, a winner of the Prix FEMA. She's been nominated 3 times for a Pulitzer Prize. And the highest honor of all, one of her books has been chosen for Oprah's book club. So why would such a woman choose to write a play? Aren't plays really written by people who aren't good enough writers to write a literary novel? Well, the short answer is no. Sometimes plays are well written. Sometimes they are very well written, like when they're written by Joyce Carol Oates. Ms. Oates writes for the theater because she respects it. How do I know? You can tell from her plays. Her plays do not pander. They do not speak to the lowest common denominator. They do not set out to entertain. There is nothing formulaic, nothing schematic. She does not proclaim the theme in a ringing speech for the lead actor. She does not tie up all the loose ends at the end of the play with a neat little bow. That can be disconcerting for an audience who expects those things. After all, they've paid their money. She does not follow the current trend of producing a life-affirming and uplifting ending. Joyce just tells the story, whatever the story is. And it's up to us, the audience, to figure out what it all means, what it means to us. And that's the point, isn't it? To interpret for yourself what is the point and the meaning of this dramatic piece of art. Not what the New York Times or the New Yorker thinks, but what do I think? Fair enough. I've told you what her plays are not, so what are they? Her plays are tough. Joyce Carol Oates gives David Mamet a run for his money. This is the woman who wrote famously, after all, about boxing and manhood and masculinity. Ms. Oates is famous for writing about violence and the darker side of life. In fact, when Oates started writing in the 1960s, she was challenged for writing so often about violence. She was told that she wrote like a man, that it was in some sense unfeminine to write about such things. Thank goodness it's more acceptable for a woman to write about these issues now, but it's still unusual for a woman to write about it so extensively. So Oates's plays are not easy. You have to work. You have to use your brain a little bit. Sometimes the plays are somewhat abstract. We're all used to abstract visual art, so it's about time to get used to some abstract theatrical art. And there are quite a few ideas in the works. Oates' plays are primal, like Greek tragedies. Sometimes she talks about things that are not nice to talk about. Remember when your mother taught you not to talk about sex, politics, or money at a dinner party? Well, Ms. Oates talks about these kind of taboo topics in depths. Oates writes from the purest place for a playwright to write from. She has a story and she tells it unstintingly, unflinchingly, unjudgmentally, fearlessly. She tells the truth as she sees it. It reminds me of the acting advice James Cagney gave a young actor. Look the other guy in the eye and tell him the truth. And that's what she does. Her work is a series of contrasts, light and dark, good and evil, pain and pleasure, ignorance and eruditeness. Her plays are truthful, visceral, vulnerable, kinesthetics. You feel them in your bones. Passionate, earnest, dryly funny and ironic, and wistful. They are intuitive, insightful, mysterious, strange, and odd. Joyce Carol Oates is the natural heiress to Edgar Allan Poe. Both are master storytellers. They both tempt us to the dark side. If we're willing to go there, as Oates is willing to go there, then the benefits are manifest. To see life in all of its shades and facets is to appreciate and experience and understand it more fully. To watch an Oates play takes courage, but she sets us a good example. She had the courage to write it. Let's follow her lead and look fear in the face. It's worth it. The first play that we're going to do is called The Adoption, and then we're going to have a monologue called The Boy.
An adoption agency office. Sterile surroundings. A large clock. At the start, the clock measures real time by subtle degrees. It begins to accelerate.
So excited. Frightened.
It's the day we've been waiting for. I'm sure.
Do you think, Oh, I don't dare to hope.
Well, they were encouraging last time.
Yes, they were. They were.
They wouldn't send us away again empty-handed, would they?
Well, they did last time and the time before that.
Yeah, but this is going to be different, okay? I'm sure, right? They hinted.
No, but all they said, they promised.
No, not a promise exactly, but they...
It was a promise. In all but words.
They hinted. But today is the day.
The day we've been awaiting for so long.
So long.
I feel like a bride again.
Oh, you look like a Madonna.
It's a delivery.
A deliverance.
Can't just live for ourselves alone. A woman, a man.
No, that's selfish.
It's unnatural.
Lonely.
So lonely.
A home without
children.
It's empty.
Not what you'd call a home.
But we have means. I mean, we can afford to extend our boundaries.
Thank God.
Right. I mean, we're not millionaires. I mean, thank you, God. Thank you, God. But we're just comfortable.
Comfortable. Comfortable Americans.
Right? Educated, middle class.
Oh, dear. Aren't we upper class? I mean, your salary.
Well, you know. We're not millionaires.
Well, we paid off our mortgage. We have a tiny little nest egg. We've made sensible long-term investments.
We are what you call medium comfortable. We can afford to extend our boundaries and begin a family.
A family? After 12 years of waiting.
Actually, 13, darling.
I mean, 12 years of marriage. I not just waiting. I mean,
we've
been 13?
It's 13. We've been happy, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, I wouldn't call our marriage exactly waiting for 13
for
years.
For a baby.
For a family.
A darling little baby.
Strapping young son.
We've done plenty of other things.
Certainly have. We certainly have. Hobbies, travel. We paid off our mortgage.
We've been happy. I mean, we love each other, after all.
Sure do. Sweetest gal in the world.
We've been happy.
Damn happy.
We have snapshots to prove it.
Albums of snapshots to prove it.
Of course, every now and then.
In the interstices of happiness.
Between one heartbeat and the next.
In the early insomniac hours of morning, maybe.
In the bright lit maze of a food store.
Like fissures of deep, dark shadow at noon.
We have sometimes for maybe just a
just for
you
a
know,
fleeting second.
Teensy weensy fleeting second.
It's just a fleeting. Been a bit lonely.
So lonely.
Good morning. You are Mr. and Mrs.
That's awesome.
Mr. and Mrs. So glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you.
Is this the right time?
No time like the present. That's agency policy.
An excellent policy.
Very good. Very, very excellent. Sir.
And you are punctual, Mr. and Mrs. I see.
We're very punctual. Very punctual.
Always have been.
We've actually been here since 7:45 a.m. when the custodial staff unlocked the building.
Mm-hmm. We came to the city last night. We're staying in a hotel.
A medium-priced hotel.
we were terrified of missing our appointment.
I wouldn't say we were terrified.
We were vigilant. Yes, it is wise to be punctual. Such details in prospective parents are meticulously noted.
Right, right. And so today is the day?
The day?
Yes. Yes, today is your day, Mr. and Mrs. Your application to adopt one of our orphans has been fully processed by our board of directors and approved.
Oh, God.
Congratulations.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Thank you so much.
X strides to the door and leads in Nabo.
Here he is, Mr. and Mrs., your baby.
Oh, my God.
Nabo is perhaps 8 years old. He wears a mask to suggest deformity or disfigurement. He has a mild twitch or tremor.
So, here we are. Here we have Nabo. Say hello to your new mother and father, Nabo.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Say hello to your new mother and father, Nabo. Hello.
He isn't an actual baby, is he?
No, Nabo is 8 months old, to the day.
8 months?
Oh, but he's so sweet, so...
Our records are impeccable.
What did you say
childlike.
His name was?
Childlike. So...
Nabo.
Trusting.
Nabo.
So needful of our love.
So his name is Nabo.
Nabo? Nabo?
Nabo?
Say hello.
Maybe he doesn't know English?
Oh, of course he doesn't. That's the problem. Hello, Nabo. You've come a long distance to us, haven't you? Don't be frightened. We are your new mommy and your daddy. We'll teach you everything that you will need to know.
We sure will.
Mister has taken a camera out of his briefcase and takes pictures of Mrs. posing with Nabo. Nabo is rigid with the terror of the flash.
Oh, it's beautiful. That's beautiful. It's the first minute of our new life.
This is a holy time. I feel God's presence here.
Excuse me, but is Nabo, is there a boy or a girl?
Dear, don't be crude.
I'm only curious.
You didn't specify, did you? You checked either sex.
Oh yes. Either.
I was just curious. Okay, I'm daddy, after all.
He's
right?
Daddy, dear, and I'm mommy. We've waited so long for you, only for you, dear. Can you say daddy? Mommy?
Daddy, mommy.
Of course, you're shy. I mean, you've come such a long distance.
From the dark side of the earth.
Don't be so grim, dear. This isn't the right tone. Little baby bunting, daddy's gonna hunting, gonna get a new fur skin.
To wrap the baby bunting. I can't believe this is real.
Now, Nado.
Nabo.
That's what I said.
It's Nabo.
Nado.
dear.
Nabo. That's what I said? My goodness. Look, Nabo, darling, just for you. I mean, isn't she lovely?
Nabo, look what Daddy has for you, huh? Cool, huh? Vroom, vroom, vroom. It's cool, huh?
Excuse me, Mommy and Daddy. If you could please sign on the dotted line, Nabo is yours forever.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. just one further detail.
What is that?
Well, it appears that Nabo has a twin.
Oh, a twin?
From whom Nabo is said to be inseparable.
Inseparable?
They must be adopted together, you see.
A twin? I don't...
The minute hand of the clock continues to accelerate.
Yes, an identical twin.
Identical? As in identical to our...
Frequently, our adoptees are from large families. The term twin is merely generic.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, isn't our Nabo just one of a kind?
Nabo is indeed one of a kind. We are all one of a kind.
What does that mean?
But Nabo has a twin from whom Nabo is inseparable.
Inseparable.
Hell, I'm game.
let's do it.
Nabo. Another just like you.
Right? Two for the price of one, huh?
No, but Daddy, I mean, are we prepared? I mean, we never had one and now two.
Isn't that the way things always come, right? Isn't that the way twins always come in two? Surprising
mommy
and daddy
like
that. It's really something.
I regret to say,
Mr. and Mrs., that our agency requires in such situations that adoptive parents take in both siblings. For given the fact of identical twins, there can be no justification in adopting one instead of the other.
Well, that's so...
I think you got us there, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there are so many deserving applicants registered with our agency, you see. Our waiting list is years long.
We want them both, of course.
Yes, I'm game. Didn't I say that?
You're certain, Mr. and Mrs.?
Yes.
We're certain.
X goes to the door and opens it and leads in Nabo with some ceremony.
This, Mr. and Mrs., is Nabo.
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 Okay. Hi.
What a long, long distance you have come to us, Nabo. Nabo.
Nabo. Nabo.
Yet we are fading.
Right from the dark side of the earth, from the beginning of time.
We'll teach you the English language.
The American English language, right? It's the greatest language on earth.
We'll bring you to our home.
Your home, now.
We'll love you so you never forget what it is that you've escaped.
That's for sure. No looking back.
No looking back. You'll be American children. No past.
We're your new mommy and daddy now, okay? Do you know what that means?
He's daddy.
I'm mommy. No, I'm daddy. I'm actually daddy.
I'm mommy. She's
mommy and I'm daddy.
Of course. I knitted this myself for you.
Oh,
sweet. Oh, dear. There's only one.
Is there a...
Well, thank goodness, you know, I knitted this too.
You think of everything, sweetheart. From now on, you'll have to knit in matching sets, dear. From now on, everything must be in duplicate for our little...
I do need your signatures, Mr. and Mrs., before the adoption procedure can continue.
Okay.
Oh, I nearly forgot you must be starving. having come so far. I made this chocolate walnut fudge just yesterday.
Nabo and Nadbo take pieces of preferred fudge, taste it hesitantly, begin to eat, ravenously, and spit mouthfuls out.
Oh, dear. Oh. Well, you mustn't be greedy, you know. There's plenty to eat here.
Nabo and Nadbo snatch the rest of the fudge, shoving pieces into their mouths, and soon spit it out again. Nadbo has a minor choking fit.
Okay, guys. Everybody say smile! Smile!
This is the happiest day of my life. Thank you, God.
This is the happiest day of my life.
Mister hands X the camera so that he can take a picture of the new family. Mr. and Mrs. smiling broadly, Nabo and Nadbo cringing.
Lovely. Now we should complete our procedure. Your signatures, please.
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry, just a moment. I'm afraid that Nabo and Nadbo have a third sibling.
I'm sorry.
A third?
Are you saying another twin?
Not twin, exactly. With these high fertility races, the precise clinical term is too clinical. Let's say identical sibling.
So triplets?
Not triplets, exactly. Identical sibling is preferred.
Another one of you. How wonderful! Your mother must have been. If you had one, I mean,
whatever. I'm afraid. You know what, honey? We really can't. Okay,
yeah.
It's three, right? Not three. We'd only prepared for one.
We left home yesterday to drive here, we'd only prepared enough diapers, a single bassinet, a third baby. It's impossible. I did always want a large family.
But darling, not in 5 minutes.
But we can buy a new house, more bedrooms, bunk beds, a bigger family room. I was so lonely in my parents' house, just the one of me, and everything done for me. Never a moment's want or deprivation. My mother was from a large family, 8 children, dozens of grandchildren.
But not in 5 minutes.
What difference does it make?
Not in 5 minutes!
We've been infertile, sterile, for 14 years. I mean, we've got a lot of catching up to do.
13 years, wasn't that it?
I mean, here is our deliverance. These tragic orphans from the dark side of the earth. Human beings can't live for themselves alone.
Darling, please, you're hysterical, all right? You're not being yourself.
Who am I then?
Darling.
Mr. Mrs., I'm afraid your allotted time has nearly transpired. Even as you dally, this past hour, 110,273 new tragic orphans have been, it's said, born.
Sweetheart, I think we're being misled here, all right? I think we are being cruelly manipulated, and I strongly object.
If you had trouble to read the agency's restrictions and guidelines handbook, mister, more closely, you would not affect such a surprise now.
I did read it, okay? I've practically memorized it. You've been on your damn waiting list for a decade.
There is a third sibling identical with our...
Identical DNA, chromosomes, identical faces and bodies, but, you know, not identical inwardly, in the soul.
Yeah, the soul, yes. Yes.
Darling, it's just that we can't. All right? We don't have enough room.
Of course we have the room.
We don't have the resources for this.
Of course we have resources.
Look, we're practically in debt.
We're wealthy.
We're paupers.
We're wealthy. We have infinite space inwardly.
Inwardly?
The soul is infinite, isn't it? I mean, mine is. Isn't yours?
It's all very nice to say, but my soul? Okay, where is my soul?
You tell him. The soul is infinite, isn't it? The kingdom of God is within. The space goes on forever.
Nabo and Nadbo make mournful keening sounds and rock back and forth, their small bodies hunched. They make a break for the closed door.
Where are you going, Nabo? Oh, no, you're Nadbo. I mean, Nabdu, Nabu. Come here, be good. You're ours, aren't you? Mommy loves you so much.
Daddy loves you so much. Okay, since the beginning of time.
Before the beginning of time.
Nabo and Nadbo cower, hiding behind X. The mournful keening sound seems to be coming from all over.
Oh, what is that sound? It hurts my ears.
Nadbo and Nadbu, just boys, girls, stop that.
It's just some village dirge. Nothing. Pay no attention.
Bad boys.
It's coming from here, too.
Mrs., this door can only be opened by authorized agency personnel.
Darling, what is it?
That door was not to be opened. I could call a security guard and have you arrested, Mrs., taken out here in handcuffs.
Oh, God.
What did you see, Darling? What did you see?
Mrs. saw nothing. There was nothing to be seen.
Darling, it's okay.
Take him back to the hospital.
What did you see, Darling? What's behind that door?
Take him back. We don't want that.
I thought so. Poor risks for adoption.
Darling, are you certain? Because we've waited so long.
Take them away.
We've waited,
all of
we've
them.
Prayed for so
Take
long.
Take them away. We're not strong enough.
You're certain, Mr. and Mrs.? You can never again apply with our agency, you know.
We're sorry. We're so sorry.
X marches Nabo and Nadbo out. The door behind
sorry.
Them.
Sorry?
The morning keening sound grows louder. The minute hand continues its accelerated progress. Morning sound ceases.
What have we done?
It was a wise decision.
Yes, sir.
It was a necessary decision. It was your decision.
Waited all our lives.
It was your decision. We had to.
Our day of birth, delivery.
And deliverance.
Weren't strong enough.
No, you weren't. I'm sorry. We both weren't strong enough. Who the hell is strong enough? Okay, with that, I'd like to know.
God didn't make us strong enough.
It's a rational decision, okay? It was necessary. It was necessary.
What have we done, my baby?
Look, I'm only human, okay? What can I do? Who can forgive me? Who can forgive you, sweetheart? Who isn't human? You cast the first stone.
That corridor, that space to the horizon, so many, and that smell.
I know, there isn't room. Okay, there isn't room for us. There isn't room in the human heart. I mean, the home, the house. No matter how many bunk beds, we're not paupers, but we're not millionaires. Who's been saying we are? How many? Four, five, six. How many?
Our home, a house.
Hey, there's us.
Lonely.
It's a rational, necessary decision, okay? No choice.
Someone.
Look, I refuse to be manipulated by, I don't know, to be made guilty?
Many years of waiting and so lonely.
Who the hell isn't human? We had no choice.
No choice.
And we're not millionaires.
Goodbye, Nabo. Nabo. You're innocent babies. Mommy loves you so.
Goodbye, sons. Goodbye, boys.
Don't forget us. Goodbye.
Your daddy loved you.
Mommy loved you too. Goodbye.
Goodbye, sons.
Bye.
Be brave.
Bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
The end.
Boy named Kit. As soon as I started subbing for his class, pestered me, you know, with love. He called out, hey, good looking on the street. Eyed me every chance he could, you know. Hey, teach, you're a peach. He's got these incredible brown eyes. Smooth, peachy down skin, you know, like he hardly needed to shave. Didn't look 15, but claimed he was 17, which might have been true. So, all right, I said, all right, damn you. I drove us to this place outside town, in the woods. Motel's supposed to look like a hunting lodge. Mm-hmm. Fake logs with, like, painted on knot holes. I brought along 3 6-packs, of course. We started drinking in the car. And the room smelled like damp and old bedclothes. You know, somebody's hair oil or maybe Airwick. You know the smell? I mean, I know the smell. It's my strategy, okay, to praise them. Oh, actually, I mean every single word I say. Just want them to feel good, you know? Good. Good. So we're fooling around, out of breath, getting excited. Quick kisses, you know, nervous wisecracks. You know, you roll your head off laughing and then can't remember 5 minutes later. Hey, let's dance, I said. You know how to dance, kid, right? And we're falling on the bed and we're tangling and kicking. And I opened his pants and I took hold of him there, but he was soft, breathing fast and shallow like some scared animal. Was he afraid? Why? Of me? I mean, hey, why? I blew in his ear, got him giggling. I teased. I said, okay, kid, now's your chance. Mommy's ain't anywhere near. I kissed and I tickled and I rubbed up against him. And oh, God, I was so hot. My head was sort of spinning, going fast around like in the, you know, like a turn in the mountains. You know, it was like my hair was streaming out behind me, like it hasn't done in like 15 years. I was crying, or no, I was laughing. I wanted to get him hard, damn it, you know, big and hard and strong like a man, deep inside me like a man, and then I'd whisper how great he was, how fantastic. Make us both feel like $1,000,000, like I deserve some happiness, don't I? I mean, you know, I'm a human being, aren't I? I'm not just some sub, grateful for shitty part-time work, 23 miles. I have to drive in one direction, 30 in the other, and never anything more than a one-year contract. I'm sorry, but that's how it is. You take it or leave it, Ms. Snyder. You know, tough luck. And then there's these pouches under my eyes, and this twisty look that scares the nice shy boys. And this voice that's in my head, you know, is it me? Oh, God, God, is it me? Well, he never did get hard. But it just felt like something that's been skinned, naked, like a velvety little baby rabbit. And he was tense and trembling, like I'd hurt him, or he was afraid of me. Afraid I might hurt him. And finally, he whispers, "I guess I don't love you. I guess I want to go home." But I didn't even hear him. I was thinking, oh, fuck, beer's going to get warm. Shut my eyes, seeing the road tilt and spin in the sky, opening up like we're all being sucked into it. "Hey, let's dance, kid, come on," I said, giggling. "Let's knock the shit out of this room." He was laughing, too. I mean, maybe he was crying, nose running, like a little baby's. And I just lay there, thinking, all right, kid. All right, you bastards. This is it.
This was last Christmas. I was hanging out at the house, lots of relatives dropping in, and my mother's brothers come by bringing six packs, and got to drinking and bullshitting. And my old man, Everett Tiggs's name comes up. Nobody's spoken in that house in 20 years. And my mom gets up and walks out of the room that way she does. Makes you feel like shit, that hurt look in her face. He left us. I was 8 years old. Just disappeared. Nobody knew he was alive or dead for a long time. Fucker. So my Uncle Duke is saying, "You know, I heard Everett Tiggs is in a VA hospital in Pittsburgh. Bad case of lung cancer." And the others are saying, "Hell with Tiggs. That bastard is dead to all of us." Nobody's looking at me like they're ashamed, and I'm... It's weird. I'm sitting there with a beer in my hand and my eyes open, but I'm like... gone. My old man, Everett Tiggs, I'd sort of been led to think was dead all these years. So next morning, I'm on my way to Pittsburgh. 30 hours on the interstate. Told my mom I had to get away. Decided to drive down to Fort Lauderdale with some guys from work, and she goes, "I never can count on you, can I?" What I'm figuring is, I'll just take a look at the old man. Wouldn't give him the satisfaction of identifying myself. Walking out like he did, leaving us, my mom and two sisters and me. Used to be, he'd let me ride up high in the cement mixer cab with him, and the cement turning around behind. "It's got to turn. If it doesn't turn, it goes solid and the goddamn truck goes over," my old man said, laughing. He'd called me kiddo. Out back at school, in the playground, he'd pitch balls to me. They said I look like him. My hair and face. Jesus, it makes you feel ashamed. You never get over it. People looking at me and seeing him. As soon as I turned 16, for sure I quit school. Moved out of the house, but not too far away. I'm always looking after my mom. But not too close. Driving to Pittsburgh, I was saying aloud, look, I don't hate you. I just want to ask why. Why the fuck that you would leave us like that and not say goodbye? And load the car like you did? Your hunting stuff and power tools and other shit? So it was premeditated, you know, fucking knew you were never coming back. And mom waiting and getting scared, then crazy and wild, screaming at us, blaming us. Even at church, there's people looking down on us where you'd expect better, fuckers. So driving to Pittsburgh, I'm thinking I wouldn't say a word. I'd just stand where I could watch you, and maybe I could forgive you. I don't know, if maybe it was meant for me to forgive you. If God gave me a sign. So I'm kind of excited. And scared. And I get there. Pittsburgh. And go to the VA hospital and tell them I'm looking for Everett Tiggs. How he was my father I hadn't seen in 20 years. And they tell me he's gone. I say, what? Gone? They say, we're sorry, Mr. Tiggs. Your father is dead. He died here December 3rd. Telling me more how he was cremated at his own bequest. He'd said no next of kin. And there was nobody to notify or give his things to. He was 52 years old. They asked, did I wish a copy of the death certificate? And I said, nah, no thanks. What the hell? Look, it ain't like I'm sad or anything. I'm not. It ain't like I lost anything I ever had. All I was going to do was stand where I could look at my father. Just possibly I'd walk past him by his bed or wherever and see, would he look at me? Maybe recognize me. Like maybe he'd go, son, is that you? And maybe that would have been the sign God sent that I could forgive him. Maybe. I don't know. Look, you know I love you, but I told you and told you I'm not the kind of guy to play games with. When I call and you don't answer, what am I going to think? You want me to think what? I'm not the kind of guy who's going to be pushed around. So we better get this cleaned up right now. You act like you're scared of me. How's that make me feel, for Christ's sake? I love you. It's just that I'm getting seriously pissed off the way things are going, you know? Like this game you're playing, like you're scared of me? That's an insult.
I was scared last night. I almost thought
for 1 minute you were betraying me. Jesus Christ.
The first time I saw you.
I don't know. Sometimes I think we'd both be better off dead. Jesus, I'm crazy about you.
The first time I saw you,
I knew.
A prolonged kiss. That's the whole play.
Okay.
If you could see out this window. Oh, streets converge, crowds, traffic. This must be the center of the world where all the winds rush together. Oh, there's a building across that's exactly like this building. Oh, perhaps it's a mirror image, and I mean, I see a mirror Shelley right there, looking at the windows, looking out. Most of the windows are boarded up. That building's condemned, too, like this one. Another Peter owns it. Or maybe it's my Peter, my lover. Oh, she isn't waving back. Just a face, a very pale face, with eyes set deep in her sockets. She isn't cute like me. He wouldn't love her.
The very first night I brought her here, she acted exactly like that. Always posing, showing off, primping, preening. As if before an audience of very interested and sympathetic people, the way girls do. It's so American, so cute, a curse, so cute. Girls are, well, so cute. You can shake them until their eyes roll back in their skulls. You can hug them until their ribs crack. You can knock their pretty front teeth off, and still they're posing for you. Anxious and hopeful, sweet little things, their underarms shaved, hairless, and innocent, a sign of great virtue, right? Cute as cheerleaders. In fact, many of them have been cheerleaders. Several among my wide acquaintance. And Shelley, too. Wait, is Shelley her name? Shelley. Yes. My Shelley. Observe her. After 45 days of this, she's still ready to break into a cheer, jump up and stretch her shapely little body, leading our team to victory and all that.
The first night, I ran to the window, right here. I pushed the glass. Did I want to jump out? It's 5 stories down to the sidewalk. Or did I want to scare him? My new boyfriend. I wonder how I looked. My hair was long then. My skin was clear. I know I was pretty. All girls are my age. All girls at my age are pretty, more or less. We can't help it, right? I remember pushing at the window, standing here, my long hair. People out on the street, late Saturday afternoon, just lots of people, the smell of food, late Saturday afternoon, and I just wanted to push the window apart and just see if people could see me here. I wanted to cry out to them, look, it's me, it's Shelley, I've come here to live with you. And I'm going to be one of you. And I'm in love. Peter V came up behind me and put his arms around me. Oh, he loved me then. He loved me for a week or two. He told me it was the longest he'd ever loved anyone.
A girl of 16 or 17 like that girl is irresistible. Even if you've been out on business for 3 days, as I have, 3 straight days with only a few hours sleep, collecting fees, paying people off, making telephone calls in and out of taxis and in and out of buildings. What a life. I know too many people. Too many girls like this one. Still. She's irresistible, isn't she? Look at her healthy, gleaming hair. Look at her healthy body. The very heartland of America is between her ribs, I promise you. Her legs are pearly and long and lovely. About her is only the odor of talcum powder and cornflakes. Nothing more, I promise you. The Girl Scout insignia is tattooed on her breast. I promise all that and more.
I thought I was calling out for people down there to see me so that they would be jealous. After all, Peter had picked me. But now I think I was calling out for help. He had locked the door already. I couldn't get out. He locked the door first, then he pressed me flat on the floor. Not on the mattress. It wasn't here yet. He kept banging my head against the floor, making love to me. He convinced me that I didn't exist. My body broke up into pieces in his hands. It's all different pieces.
Is she trying to break the window? Trying to jump out? I'm not going to let her. Not yet. But look at that spirit she has. What muscles. What a lovely girl. How much is she worth to you? She has held up very well. It must have been her excellent family. The good dental care and fortified cereal and the fuzzy-lined boots. She is from an excellent suburb in one of our great American cities. Great care went into her making, centuries of care. She's a Midwestern beauty. Look, she's preening. She's posing out of sheer exuberance.
He broke my body into little pieces. It was like a jigsaw puzzle. It was right here on the floor. This spot here, but there's no mark. There's no blood. Like, people get nailed to the floor and bleed to death, and there's no mark to show what they've been through. No evidence. No proof of their existence. The world is crowded with invisible people who can't prove that they exist. Anyway, he loved me. He loved me then. He might love me again. Peter, you did love me.
You think I don't feel bad? I do. It makes me sick having to leave Muriel and Dwayne and Junie. Having to, like that part of my life's over. Just over. Whew. Just letting go. No shit about filing for bankruptcy.
I am bankrupt.
Your debts outweigh your assets by $23,580. You borrowed all you can. You're bankrupt. But to hell with that. This cousin of mine, Bobby, he was 5 years old when it happened. I was 9, and he was 5. It was an accident, him drowning that terrible way. But my fault. We had these sleds, both of us, new sleds, Christmas sleds, playing on the hill at his folks' place, sledding down, going on the creek, the Uville Creek, and Bobby broke through the ice. My uncle and aunt, they had a farm up in Schuylersville, and my dad took us up there a lot, weekends. Bobby and I played together. He looked up to me, I guess, right? Not having a big brother. We got along really well. Bobby was a nice kid. It's hard to talk. I hate talking. Any kind of serious talk, You can't do it, so why try, right? Fuck it. Okay. There was this big long hill, cow pasture, and we'd sled down to the creek. We took our sleds down the hill, but we weren't supposed to go out on the creek, even when it was frozen, because in the middle, sometimes, the ice was thin. Now, I'd take my sled out, though, and Bobby didn't tell on me. I was scared. Watching me sled out onto the ice, the steer to the side, quick before the ice cracked. There was a feeling I'd get if the ice was thin. Here. So I'd know. Okay. One day I was teasing Bobby, I guess, and he followed me out onto the ice. But instead of steering to the side like I did, he went straight out. And right away the ice started cracking. And he started screaming, and his sled broke through. He was in the water, screaming, this freezing water that's black and running fast. And I grabbed hold of him by the arm, got down on my stomach on the ice to try to keep it from breaking more. But I couldn't pull him up. I couldn't pull him out. He was screaming, "Don't let go. Don't let me go." Jesus, I'll remember that all my life. He tried to grab on to me, too, and pull himself out of the water, but he couldn't, and I couldn't get him out. The ice was breaking. The water was pulling away. I don't know how long I had a hold of him, but 10 minutes, 5, to my fingers froze, and I just had to let him go. He was screaming. He didn't want to die. There was nobody but me to save him. Nobody in the whole fucking world but me. A 9-year-old kid. I had to let him go. So he died. He drowned. I saw him go. I could see his body go. Well, that was it. Bobby died, age 5. I was to blame. All the years I was growing up, I'd hear him screaming. I hear him now. It's always there. And Bobby's folks and mine, they look at me and they think of him, of it, of what a shit I was. Getting him out on the ice, letting him go. Sure, that was what they were thinking. Still is. You think I blame them? I don't. They're right. I'm a shit. I know.
A park bench illuminated by a street lamp.
You're following me? Looking at me? Okay. Here I am. I'm waiting. Anybody makes a move on me, I'm waiting. The first time, I'm not going to talk about it. Okay. He was my mother's brother. I'll never say his name. I won't think it either. He took me ice skating. I was going to be a figure skating champion. He said he'd be my coach. I was 6 years old. I believed him. I don't remember it too clear. "Don't you tell," he said. "Nothing happened," he said. I mean, that long ago, you mostly don't remember. So I don't talk about it anyway. He's dead. The first time I can remember, yeah, it's like yesterday. I was 12 years old. I was in seventh grade. And I was crossing through a park coming home from school, a really dark, cold day, a spring day, but gloomy, like the sky was just pressing down really low. And I was alone, and that's how you get selected. I didn't know it then. My mind was filled with, oh, such thoughts. God, I was going to be a fashion model or a girl singer in a rock band. All kinds of like crazy ideas and hopes. And I was crossing through this park, and then I saw him up ahead, and I didn't pretend to. I mean, I just pretended to myself, and that's what you're supposed to do when you're scared to death. They weren't black guys. They were white, like me. Just guys in the neighborhood, 16, 17 years old, hanging around the old bandstand smoking reefer, and I came along, and it was more like an accident, but it was fated. No, they didn't rape me or anything. They just chased after me, hooting and yelling and grabbing at me and knocking me down in the wet grass. And I was sobbing. I was so scared. I was like paralyzed, scared, and wetting my pants. So they laughed at that. Another time, a few years later, it was black guys. I'd just gotten to talking with one of them. I didn't know his name. It was in a video shop and hanging out after school. And this boy goes, "You're pretty enough to be Miss America." And just kind of jiving the way that they do. And I was like, "Yeah, I guess I am." And we went out, and there's his buddies in a car. And I got in, and like 3 hours they had me. And they made me do all these things to them, like five or six, just behind the warehouse and by the river. And they terrorized me, and they told me that they'd kill me for sure and dump my body in the river if I told, or they'd torch the building where Mama and I live, just the two of us. So I never told. I mean, who am I supposed to tell? Mama? No, she'd die of shame. The old priest, old Potbelly McGuire. I mean, the cops in our precinct wouldn't give a damn. "You're asking for it, for going out with black guys," they'd say, "and it serves you right." Just guys in the neighborhood, they wouldn't say nothing. So I couldn't just go to the doctor or the hospital, which I didn't, just because I was too ashamed. Oh, I was 20 years old and I fell in love for the first time. Oh my God. Fell right, like into quicksand. Quicksand. Just doing temp work, days, evenings. I was taking courses at Monroe County Community College, where I met Ray Alice, my accounting professor. And I was just admiring him in class, just shy, because I am shy. And one evening after class, he asks if I'd like to have coffee with him in the student union. And that was the beginning. He was separated from his wife, so, I mean, I believed him. I'm the kind of girl that I always believe. That's how you get selected, but I didn't know it then. And I came to love Ray Alice. So, I lost 15 pounds. I couldn't sleep. I'd just lie in the bath till the water got cold and my skin was all puckered like chicken skin and white and just half wanting to die there, you know, just like slash my arms with a razor. And I was so tensed up and was like hopeful that he was going to marry me. "Ray Alice loves me," he says. "He loves me." He just kisses me all over my body when we're together in his car in a motel room, and I'm thinking, Oh, God, what if he doesn't smile at me tomorrow in class when I see him? What if he doesn't call me again? Like, my heart was just clenched tight with hope. Well, Ray didn't leave his wife and kid. And I'd call him sometimes. And I'd hang up when his wife answered. Until he changed his number. I used to drive by his house at night and park out there. Somebody called the police once. Maybe it was him.
He draws a pistol out of her skirt pocket. He sights along the barrel and strokes it against the side of her face.
This I didn't have in my possession then. Just holding it. The weight of this. It really restores your pride. I'm not 20 anymore. Sure not. Lots of water over the dam since. Mama died. I grew up. Ooh, you better believe it. Just try me. You, mister. There's going to be a time. An hour. Oh, yes. You're going to press up against me, all innocent seeming, in a bar. Some singles Friday night in a parking garage elevator or anywhere. A grocery store. 7-Eleven. There's no gonna be that time that's an accident, but fate. No way to avoid it. Just say I'm coming out of a women's restroom at a gas station on an interstate and you see me in like shorts and a t-shirt, sunglasses, and you're headed for the men's room and the two of us collide, right? Just you bumping into me accidentally on purpose, right? The way you do. Or say it's dusk, a melancholy like now, and you're curious why this woman, why this not bad-looking woman is sitting here by herself in a park. The park's deserted, and she's sitting here looking lonely, low, and sad, and there's these bruises under her eyes from not sleeping, or maybe some guy's been beating up on her, which excites you, right? Mister, turns you on. So you follow her here. Well, sure. Try me. It's a date. Here I am.
This is a selection from Zombie. My name is Quentin P. This is my new apartment in the basement of my grandmother's old house where she doesn't live anymore. And I am caretaker. I am turning over a new leaf. Starting fresh, starting over. Because I am an admitted sex offender. I am not a racist. I don't know what a racist is. The boy was black, and Quentin P. is white. And the lawyer advised Dad this was a delicate issue in Mount Vernon right now, and the courts are carefully monitored. Just be grateful we didn't draw a black judge. How does your client plead? The judge asked. And the lawyer said, Your Honor, my client pleads guilty. But in my heart, I did not plead guilty because I was not guilty and am not. But it was a racial matter. It is the word of a white man, unmarried, 31 years old, against the charge of a black boy from the projects, 12 years old. There is not much mystery guessing what probably occurred. I held it tight in my hand, tickling the tip with the tip of the ice pick. But the pills had not yet taken effect, for I was impatient and exhibited poor judgment. I see in retrospect that I was drunk. And the boy panicked, beginning to bellow as he broke free, like an animal crashing through the locked rear door of the Ford van. So help me God, I don't know how. And running naked but for his filthy t-shirt out into the street, bellowing like a fire alarm rising louder and louder, my zombie escaped. That boy was supposed to be my first zombie. Quentin P. was allowed to plead guilty to sexual misdemeanor committed against a minor. When Judge L. pronounced 2 years, there was a long moment before he added, suspended sentence. He knows my dad. Judge L. said I had to do psychotherapy and counseling, plus regular reports to a probation office. Now we're going to turn over a new leaf, aren't we, son? Yes, Dad. Thank you. Thank you for your faith in me. I had such a feeling of homecoming and being loved. Fuck the past. It's not now. Nothing not now is real. The past is past and you learn to move on. Maybe I'll become a born-again Christian. I have been driving Mom and Grandma to church and have attended 4 Sundays in a row. Amen. Of all of them, of Mom and Dad and Grandma and my sister Junie, it has been hardest on Dad, I know. It is upsetting for Professor R.P., a distinguished man, a distinguished professor, to learn certain things about his only son, and these things a matter of public record. I will live up to your trust from now on, Dad, I told him. Dad's medical insurance pays for my medication. And the therapist asks, your medication? Are you still taking your medication? Yes, sir. Of course, sir. Goodbye, sir. Moving your asshole mouth and, no, sir, I am saying. Screw you, I am saying. I am not doing well, I guess. Or maybe just okay. I make no eye contact with anybody. Eye contact has been my downfall. Thank you to the actors. Thank you all very much. And we can take just a couple of minutes if anybody has any questions about Joyce's work or anything you just heard or saw. Yeah? Yeah, a number. Joyce is very prolific as a playwright as well as a novelist, so her plays have often been done at the MacArthur Theater because she's close friends with Emily Mann, who runs the theater there. The plays have also been done at the Humana Festival. and also here in, at EST and some work with the Actors Studio in Europe.
And the monologue, was it an evening monologue?
It was kind of a group, yeah. Her most famous play, which is a group of monologues, is called I Stand Before You Naked, which is all female monologues, and we'll be doing several of those in 2 weeks' time. But several of the pieces are just standalone monologues, which are not meant to be necessarily done with anything else. And that very, very short dialogue that they did, that was the whole play, what you heard. Anybody else have a question? She does. For this, we're doing some shorter works, but she does have several full-length productions, yeah. Yes, yes, ma'am.
Joyce likes to answer such questions with a sort of a vague, it is open to interpretation, it is open to your interpretation.
your worst nightmare.
I myself might have envisioned an army of those strange creatures, but it really could be anything.
The way they're talking about it, I think they're in some form a monster. You know, what kind of monster is not clear, and what that monster represents is open to your interpretation. Anyone? Yes, yes, ma'am. Actors are not normal people. This is what we do. I know it. I know from the outside it can look kind of funny, but depending on the actor you talk to, some of them are actually more at home up here than they are sitting in the chair on the side. But I do understand your point. I did hear or saw a video where John Gielgud said that the most difficult thing he ever had to do, he did Seneca's Oedipus. And Peter Brook, normally he goes off stage and he gouges his eyes off stage. But Brook had him just sit completely impassively in a chair while the messenger described him gouging his eyes out. And then he had to just stand up and scream. So it's just something we do.
I would say that when you have language that's as rich as Joyce's, it's very easy to get caught up in it. So maybe there's an initial bit of hesitation, but after the first couple of lines, because her language is so specific, and the world that she creates, even in that small little bit, it's very easy to get caught up in it. With other playwrights, not as easy. It's almost harder to get up and do a commercial jingle than it is to get up and with such great language.
Well, zombie is. Zombie is a serial killer. Some people feel it's loosely based on Jeffrey Dahmer. So, I try to leave him over there and me over here. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, black water. Yes. Yes, that's the short answer. She, it seems to me, always, for whatever reason, her themes tend to be very dark, often very violent. Some of them, yes, are based on, or partially based on, true incidents. Her novel, for instance, Blonde, is based on Marilyn Monroe. And also she's done a recent novel about, what was the little girl who, in Colorado, Joan Benet Ramsey, little girl. So she does seem to get inspired by those kinds of, but what I think what you're talking about is she seems to somehow inhabit the character. Characters who, she may be coming next time, I don't know if she's going to be here next time, she may be, but if you see her or meet her, she's a very quiet, contained, modest, you know, lovely person. So this very lovely, soft-spoken person goes to places that are very far away from her. And I can tell you that all of these actors are very different than the characters they just played. Yes, yes. Right.
You hear about everything. I mean, every day there's some unspeakable incident happening to someone.
Yes.
So that it seemed to me that then perhaps there wasn't anyone really giving voice to it.
Uh-huh.
And some of these plays really remind me of Beckett, a small little play.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that she gave voice to,
that's right,
these things that we think about in the quiet of our own minds and maybe not even want to speak to other people about.
Yes. She does do that. So I think that's one of the things that makes her a very brave writer. Very brave. Isn't it terrible? But I agree. I think it. I and I agree with what you're saying. It's become, yeah, some other horrible.
It,
more hidden. More hidden. Oh no! But. Well, right, I guess that's...
And I think probably there was more, because there wasn't the communication we had.
Well, I
and
know,
also,
as you see it on the street, people say there's so much wrong with them.
That doesn't mean they're murderers.
Right.
It's very nasty.
But I think that there may be some truth in, yes, I do think obviously horrible things have always happened, but maybe in public discourse and the way we communicate now, there are more things that we can talk about and more things that come out. Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. Joyce writes those too. Well, thank you all so much for coming, and we have two more next week and the week after. Thank you for coming.